It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a philosopher says our online data is a part of our personal identity, so we should take online surveillance by the NSA and others very personally.
First, we're talking about the attorney general race here in Wisconsin. This is the first open attorney general election since 2002, and so far four candidates have entered the race, three Democrats, one Republican.
Tonight in Madison, there is a forum for the Democratic candidates, and WPR News reporter Gilman Halstead will be attending. Gilman's on assignment right now, but he spoke with Rob earlier this afternoon about tonight's forum and the attorney general race in Wisconsin.
Gilman, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here again.
So a forum tonight. All the candidates, I believe, are invited. Who is going to show up at the event tonight?
The three Democrats are going to be showing up. That's John Richards, Representative John Richards, and Susan Happ, who is the district attorney in Jefferson County, and Ismail Ozan, who is Dane County District Attorney. Those are the three Democrats, and they'll be at the forum tonight.
And so far, at least just one Republican announced candidate in this race.
That's right, and I don't think we really expect there to be more than that. Brad Schimmel, who is the district attorney in Waukesha County, was invited. He's not going to be coming, which is not that surprising, I would think, in a race like this, where the Republican candidate in this case would probably much rather let them fight it out and then decide and figure out who he's going to run against.
It would be weird to be the odd candidate out,
yes,
in a way, with the three from the other party there. You might just be a punching bag in a
way.
So this is Wisconsin's first open attorney general race, no incumbent running, I gather, since 2002. Is this getting a lot of attention around the state?
I think it is, yeah, because the current attorney general, J.B. Van Hollen, has really put his mark on this office in the time that he's been there. He's been really aggressive in a number of areas in terms of the crime lab and in trying to reduce internet crimes, sex crimes against children, and a range of things, an emphasis on open government and the enforcing the Sunshine Laws. And now what's going to happen when he's gone with those kinds of initiatives? I think people are interested.
And tell us a little bit about the three Democratic candidates, first of all. You gave us their titles. What do we know about them?
Well, Ismail Ozan has been district attorney in Dane County. I'm actually not sure how long now, 3 or 4 years anyway. And I guess the things about him that might be most interesting is that he got a lot of attention when he sued the legislature over the open meetings law around Act 10.
Right.
So he has a sort of record of attacking the current powers that be in that sense. He's African-American, and he is really concerned about reducing racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And I guess one other thing we might add is that he and one of the other, the Republican candidate, actually have acknowledged having drunk driving offenses when they were in their youth. Brad Schimmel, as also that became an issue early on. I think it probably won't continue to be one.
Now, Peg Lautenschlager, when she was in office, had that
ironically
issue. But that was a case where she was actually the attorney general then. So that was maybe something that dragged her campaign, maybe led to her losing in her primary.
Right. And almost certainly did lead to her losing that. But drunk driving at the same time will be an issue in this race in terms of the laws that have been being passed and the record that each of these candidates have when it comes to dealing with drunk driving offenses in their jobs as district attorneys and lawyers.
And, well, let's meet Susan Happ now, another candidate in that Democratic primary.
Right. Susan Happ is the district attorney in Jefferson County, and she got her all of these candidates got their law degrees here at UW-Madison. And she is, I think, the youngest and the one who's had the least experience. She's been the elected DA since 2005, won re-election in 2008 in Jefferson County, and is emphasizing her perhaps ability to reach across the aisle, but also perhaps to do a better job of defeating a Republican, because she's the only elected Democrat in Jefferson County, and she's been reelected.
Okay, and she's been endorsed, I gather, by Emily's List.
Yeah, that's the big news this week, that there's going to be some money flowing her way because she's been endorsed by Emily's List that raises money for female candidates around the country.
And then you mentioned John Richards, the remaining Democratic
candidate.
John
Richards is a representative, state representative from Milwaukee. He's been in the legislature since 1998. He's had maybe a little bit less prosecutorial experience than some of the than the others, although he did serve in the Kenosha County DA's office before he became a legislator.
And then on the Republican side, their one candidate. Can you give us a taste of where he's coming from?
Brad Schimmel has been the Waukesha DA for quite some time, and he has championed a lot of sort of innovative work in terms of dealing with drunk driving in particular and creating these victim impact panels. He's very concerned as a prosecutor in defending and promoting victims' rights of all kinds, but that's one of the things. And in a recent Q&A with other reporters, he's emphasized that he's concerned about federal overreach. He singled out this thing that has to do with the Affordable Care Act, that he opposes the ability of the federal government to tell church-run hospitals that they have to cover abortions in their insurance policies.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the job these four are going after, the attorney general job. A lot of times it's referred to as the top cop of Wisconsin. Is it more accurate to say it's the top lawyer of Wisconsin?
Yes, it is the top lawyer. I think it gets the top cop label because the emphasis, especially during campaigns, is their role in convicting criminals and supporting district attorneys and prosecuting criminals. But certainly they do a lot more. They defend state laws. That our current attorney general has been doing that in court recently in terms of the – or his office has in terms of the voter ID mm-hmm. law and in terms of this this abortion law as well that's requiring doctors to perform abortions to have admitting privileges at least within 30 miles. So they're defending state laws and often handing down opinions, which are not like Supreme Court opinions, but their interpretation of a law and how it should be enforced.
The campaign will cover a lot of the prosecutorial issues, as you just mentioned, but the things, those items you just mentioned, things like Act 10, voter ID, abortion, whoever's the next attorney general is going to be asked to weigh in on these issues again right. and again, aren't they?
Yes, and it's even that's going to come up tonight in the forum among these three Democrats because they have all in their sort of campaign announcements recently talked about their commitment to the right to vote, the right to marry, which is now also the gay marriage amendment is now being challenged in federal court, and choice, a woman's right to choose. Mm-hmm. Those three are being emphasized, I think, by all three of these candidates. But whether or not they will now stop defending those laws, nobody has really come out and said that.
Is this a race that's going to be overshadowed by the marquee race, the run for governor?
I think to a certain extent, yeah. I think it will be second, it'll be second to that one. But I think it will still be a very exciting race because whoever comes out of this race between the three Democrats, I think are going to be very aggressive in trying to get a Democrat into the Attorney General's office.
All right. Well, we'll be checking in with you again and again on this one, I'm sure, Gil. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPR News reporter Gilman Halstead. He joined us to talk about Wisconsin's Attorney General race. There's been a steady stream of news in recent months about how vulnerable our online data is, from surveillance by the NSA to criminal identity theft to exploitation for commercial gain.
Recent surveys show that many people aren't happy with the way their online data is being used and abused. But our next guest says we should be more worried than we are, that we should take it personally because our online data is part of who we are, part of our identity. Colin Copeman joins us now. He's assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon and a resident scholar at the Wayne Morris Center for Law and Politics. His recent piece on InfoPolitics is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Colin, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Do you think we take intrusions on our online data seriously, or do we just kind of pay attention when it's out there in the news and but not really lose much sleep over it?
I think it's more the latter, and that's really my concern that I tried to get across in the piece in the New York Times. That a lot of people are, when they hear of these revelations, such as everything that Snowden brought out last summer, were initially very alarmed, and people react in quite serious ways. But then within a day or two, it seems to be back to normal. And we've got this sort of interesting ebb and flow going on since last summer, because there seems to be new reports coming out of the Snowden papers every week or two at this point, right? So I think people have a sense that there's something going on that they ought to be concerned with, and something going on that we ought to be, if not downright frightened of, at least wary of, that we ought to be giving more attention to these issues. But part of where I'm coming from in this issue as a philosopher is I think that people don't really have a good sense of how to put their finger on exactly what's going on. And I think there's a deep philosophical question here about exactly what is wrong with the new levels of surveillance that we're seeing.
Right. Part of the thing is people feel a distance, I think, from that data. It's something out there mostly affecting other people, affecting me just a little bit. You're making the case in part that the data out there is us. It's who we are. Why is our online self part of our personal identity?
Yeah, so I guess one of the most common arguments that that we hear as to why we shouldn't be too concerned is that, well, I've got nothing to hide, I'm doing everything right, so I don't mind surveillance because it doesn't affect me, it's not going to really affect me. And I think that kind of attitude, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's rooted in conceptions of selfhood and ways in which we've seen our identities throughout much of the 20th century, but I think there's been a big shift in identity over the last few decades that would suggest that we really are much more intimate with our data and our information than we're used to thinking. And I think one of the sort of, again, philosophical or conceptual difficulties here, or challenges here, is that this is really unprecedented in human history, right? So it's not bred into our DNA, for instance, to think about ourselves in terms of information and paperwork and digital trails that are aggregating around our lives. And it's not even really built into a lot of our institutions and our moral thinking and ethical frameworks that we've developed over the last few hundred years, because a lot of this stuff, the digital paper trail and just the physical paper trail, is remarkably new. So my idea, and it's not just my idea, and a number of people are beginning to make this kind of argument, is that our information in part constitutes who we are. So I call this informational persons. We've become informational persons. So that doesn't mean that we're just informational persons. My idea is not that, well, information has completely colonized our identity and there's nothing else to us, that we don't have bodies anymore and we're just pure information. You do find people saying that. I think that's going too far to the other extreme. My thought is just that whatever else we are, we're now also our information. We are our information, too. And one way I like to think about that is just posing a relatively simple thought experiment. Imagine that you woke up tomorrow and all of your personally identifying information had been ripped away from you, and you couldn't live within the framework of that information anymore. So your name, your social security number, all the numbers and pieces of identification around you, your health records, your education transcripts, et cetera, et cetera. And not just imagine that all that stuff is ripped from you as if, well, maybe you lost your wallet or something, or had a fire in your home and all the paperwork burned up. But imagine it was taken from you and you were never able to replace it with any other alternate forms of identification, any other alternate forms of paperwork, right? So that you had to live in the contemporary world without these informational aspects of yourself. So I think most people would find that, if not everybody, would find that extraordinarily disorienting. It's just not possible for us to live anymore without all of this personal information. So we live in a very information-rich ecology.
That highlights a point I wanted to bring up. This isn't just about people who are on the internet a lot creating extra trail. There's this kind of data about us, whether or not we go online at all ever, right?
Definitely. The internet aspect of things and the cell phone aspect of things is obviously a relatively new development, but the construction of an informational person and thinking about ourselves and presenting ourselves to various government agencies, various corporate bodies that we interact with, and just other people in an everyday context, that goes back much further. And you really see the beginnings of the construction of an informational self or a data self as recently as the late 19th century. So in doing my research, I was surprised to find that if you go back much before the 1880s, 1890s, it's really hard to see historically an image of people seeing themselves in terms of their information, right? But today, 110, 120 years later, we all readily see ourselves in terms of our information. And one kind of poignant example of that for me that I came across in my research was just the idea of the name, okay? So this is something that seems almost sort of taken for granted in a sort of 21st century Western context, that everybody would have one and only one name, and that name would be stable throughout all aspects of your life. So that when I'm on WPR, I'm Colin Copeman. When I'm talking to my students in my class here at University of Oregon, I'm Colin Copeman. When I go home at night, I'm Colin Copeman. When I'm hanging out with my friends or out in the forest, hiking the trails of Oregon, I'm Colin Copeman, right? In all these contexts, that's who I am. But that's something I think we all operate according to that. But if you go back much before the 1880s and 1890s, that kind of idea of a single name across all contexts is not very widespread. You certainly find examples of it, especially in the more upper classes. But the idea that everybody has one and only one name and they kind of have to stick to that, especially as a legal marker across all contexts, that was, to me, surprisingly new, that that's only about 120, 130 years old.
Huh. Well, are you looking for, in addition to changing the way we think about ourselves in relation to our online identity, are you looking for policy changes that might try to keep up with this changing world?
Yeah, definitely one of the most interesting angles of this is the policy and law angle. Now, I'm not a lawyer or a legal expert or a policy wonk, but I find myself increasingly gravitating there because one sees the problems in their brightest form, I think, especially in the legal context. So interestingly, in terms of concerns about privacy, the problems have tended to show up first in the legal context. So the lawyers have a first glimpse at what's going on. And there are a number of interesting lawsuits going on right now. One organization that's really working hard on behalf of what you might call digital civil liberties or informational civil liberties is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they're online at EFF.org. And they currently have two lawsuits going against the NSA. So these are pretty courageous activists in a lot of ways, right? I mean, they're suing the NSA not once but twice. And they're basically looking not only for policy change, but they're really looking for the establishment of a framework according to which the NSA would be subject to some kind of policy at all. So the Snowden revelations last summer took a lot of people by surprise, but people in the privacy and surveillance communities weren't all that surprised because they've known for at least a good 6 or 7 years, if not longer, that the NSA was conducting mass surveillance. What they didn't know, what most of us didn't know, and what was a big surprise was the extent to which this surveillance was being conducted, as it were, extra-constitutionally, without stringent judicial and executive oversight. And the NSA was just sort of out there doing their thing and not necessarily checking their T's and dotting their I's in a legal way. So a big part of what the EFF lawsuits are about is making sure that there's stringent constitutional protection and stringent constitutional oversight of these kinds of things. And I think that's an absolutely crucial first step, because if government agencies are no longer subject to the Fourth Amendment, protections against unreasonable search and seizure without a warrant, then we don't even really have a basic framework within which to seek policy changes. So the problem right now really is that there's not even, as it were, a policy context in which one could seek new policies, because everything is just so far out there with this.
We'll leave it there for now. Colin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Colin Copeman, assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. We've got a link to a piece he wrote on identity, politics, and the internet on the Central Time Facebook page.
We take a look at a drug that most of us are well acquainted with, but probably a bit hesitant to label it as such. So if you've indulged in a cup of coffee or a can of cola today, you've had a hit of caffeine. And you probably feel much better because of it. And suffice it to say, Americans have a complex relationship with the substance.
Our next guest wanted to dig into that relationship and learn more about the beverages that so many of us rely on every day. In a new book, he writes about why caffeine has such a powerful effect on everything from boosting our mood to improving our athletic performance, as well as how the companies that rely on it have avoided regulatory efforts for decades.
Joining us now is Murray Carpenter. He is a journalist and author. And his new book is Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Murray, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it is great to have you along, and I'm enjoying a delicious cup of coffee as we speak, as are many of our listeners, I imagine. And as I was reading your book, I have to say, why hasn't this history, this sort of look at caffeine been done before? What inspired you to go out and tackle this topic?
Well, it's. I wish I could say I just sort of instantly had a sort of revelation and said I have to write this book, but it's been a long process. I was a psychology major as an undergrad, and I was really interested at that point in coffee and how it does help us. You know, it can help us focus our minds, and so I wrote a paper senior year about caffeine and how it affects your mental ability, really your mental acuity. And also at the time, I was racing bicycles, and my teammates and I knew that you could take a short cup of strong coffee before a race, and it would boost your performance. So I thought better than a layperson's knowledge of caffeine before I started onto this project. And then as the energy drink controversies started to sort of bubble up, I thought it would be a good time to really dig into this and cover caffeine as a beat. But what I learned quickly was, although I thought I knew a lot about caffeine, I really didn't know caffeine at all.
You thought caffeine was your friend, but you were just nodding acquaintances, and now all of that has changed, I take it. Let's start with the idea of caffeine being a drug, because, you know, we drink our Diet Mountain Dew, we have our Red Bull, we drink our coffee, and none of us, I would guess, think that, you know, we don't look at it that way. We look at it as we're having our morning cup of coffee.
Yeah, well, I think you hit it in the introduction. We have a complex relationship with it, really. I mean, that's what it is, because it's certainly awkward to think of it as a drug, and to think that we're drinking our coffee or our tea or our colas because it has a drug that makes us feel good. But really, that is a big part of it. So there's a certain unease about it that I think a sense of maybe cognitive dissonance. On one hand, we love our coffee and we'd rather just think of it as coffee, but we're aware that caffeine's in it, and caffeine makes us feel good, and that's really what's driving the behavior.
And you know, one of the things that you mentioned is how little you knew about caffeine in that world. You thought you knew a lot, but you didn't really. And it reminds me of conversations that I think a lot of us have every day when we drink our cup of coffee or we have our soda or whatever it is. But that idea of that we're drinking it, we know sort of intellectually that it's there. But I'm guessing that most of us have no idea how much it is, whether that's good or bad. And then, you know, there'd be this periodic study that comes out that says coffee is good, coffee is bad, or whatever it might be. So we drink it regardless, and yet we don't know much about it, even though we talk about that topic all the time.
Yeah, and you're hitting on some great points there. The question of how much we take is a really, really tough one to quantify, and especially for those of us who are coffee drinkers, because the caffeine contents of coffee can vary really widely from one cup to the next. And so it's a really tough one to figure out how much you're drinking in coffee. If you're a cola drinker, it's actually pretty easy to tell, because on most colas, the caffeine quantity is labeled on the side. But the question of what harm it might do to us, that's a much more interesting question, because it really can impact our sleep, and it can provoke anxiety in some people. And so there are people who really react, you know, badly to caffeine.
And it seems as though lately there's been a lot of, I don't know if I want to call it bad press for caffeinated drinks because of some of these energy drinks that we hear so much about. They've become so ubiquitous and, you know, so many brand names and everywhere you turn. And all of a sudden it seems as though people, not just you, but people in general are taking a more thoughtful look at caffeine.
You're absolutely right. I think we can thank energy drinks for this. They have brought the issue of caffeine to the fore a little bit. And I think there are a lot of common misperceptions about energy drinks. We often hear of them as sort of hyper-caffeinated energy drinks. But a Red Bull, for example, 80 milligrams of caffeine, it's hard to get a coffee drink at Starbucks with that little caffeine. I mean, that would be like a single shot of espresso or about 4 ounces of drip brewed Starbucks coffee. So, yeah, energy drinks are prompting a big conversation about caffeine right now.
Yeah, context is everything for sure. But, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about a lot is sort of the history of it, and that's where you open your book, going back in time to the Mayans, the Aztecs, that history of chocolate. So this idea of knowing that there's something like caffeine that helps us out, there's nothing new here, really.
There's nothing new here. That's fascinating to me. The caffeine occurs naturally in plants all over the world, and wherever it occurs naturally, people have figured out how to use it as a stimulant. I mean, it's occurred organically in Mesoamerica with chocolate, in Northern Africa with coffee beans, people chewing coffee beans originally and later learning to brew them into beverages, elsewhere in Africa with cola nuts, and certainly in Asia with tea. So, yeah, people have figured this out a long time ago, that these products contain something that makes you alert, makes you feel good, and put it to use pretty quickly.
So do you sort of divide those eras into sort of an antique area and a more modern area? And if so, where do you draw that line?
Yeah, I would say the more modern era really would begin with products like Coca-Cola. And I mean not just the current formulation of Coca-Cola, but as it was formulated as a stimulant in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, because these are products that had powdered caffeine, refined powdered caffeine blended into them, as opposed to being brews of a natural product such as coffee or tea or chocolate.
And that was at about the same time, in early 20th century, at the same time when we started talking about maybe regulating this, and I think it was part of maybe the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, somewhere around there, that people started looking at caffeine and having that debate, at least in a public forum, about whether this is something that ought to be taken a closer look at.
Yes, there was a hard-charging commissioner of the agency that would become the FDA, the Bureau of Chemistry, a guy named Harvey Wiley, who really thought that Coca-Cola was a harmful product, that the caffeine that they were blending into Coca-Cola was addicting people, and that it was bad for children, and that Coca-Cola was being dishonest in its labeling because the caffeine didn't come from cola, but rather it was extracted from tea leaves. So this led to a big dramatic court case that journalists at the time called the famous Coca-Cola case that took place in Chattanooga in 1911, and it went all through the courts. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court and was eventually resolved with a consent decree. But the really interesting thing is that the questions that they were asking at that time about Coca-Cola are really the exact same questions we're asking about energy drinks today, which is it different to take caffeine when it's blended into a bottled product than when it's a natural constituent of coffee or tea? Is it an addictive substance? And really, this big question, what role should the federal government play in regulating caffeine?
It's amazing that here 100 years down the road, we're still having the same conversation. And I realize this is a big question. But why is it? Why did it take 100 years? And people have been talking about it all along, maybe not always in the headlines, but it's always sort of been there. Why hasn't the conversation sort of been as front and center?
Well, it's again because of this complex relationship we have, and at that point, a lot of the discussion got right up to coffee and then stopped. And basically, at that time, Coca-Cola was more caffeinated than it is today. It was pretty much exactly as caffeinated as Red Bull is now, but it still was not as caffeinated as coffee. And so pretty much what a lot of people said about regulating caffeine is, what next? Would you then regulate coffee? And you're seeing this exact argument playing out just this week in Maryland, where there's a bill to prohibit the sale of energy drinks to minors. And people are writing op-eds saying, you know, what next? Will you be carding people at Starbucks? So it is a tricky issue. And I think it's our relationship with coffee and naturally occurring caffeine that does make it a real challenge.
We're talking with Murray Carpenter about all things caffeine this half hour, and you can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. So what do you think about caffeine? Is it your drug of choice in coffee or Red Bull or Diet Mountain Dew? What questions do you have about caffeine? Is it good for you? Is it bad for you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also post comments to the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Murray Carpenter. He is a journalist and author of the book Caffeinated, and we're talking about our complex relationship with caffeine. We're inviting you to join the discussion at 800-642-1234. You can also post your questions and your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got some callers lined up. We'll be getting to those in just a moment. But before we do that, Murray Carpenter, you know, throughout the 20th century, one of the interesting things I learned from your book was that we started running out of natural caffeine, I think somewhere around World War II, and all of a sudden people had to start taking a look at, well, where can we get more? And the rise of synthetic caffeine has been a big part of the 20th century story, and it's a big part, I would guess then, of our consumption today.
Yeah, that really surprised me as I researched the book. Basically, there's two ways to get caffeine, the pure powdered form. One is to extract it from a naturally occurring substance like coffee, tea, or chocolate, or kola nuts. And the other is to synthesize it from urea and chloracetic acid and other chemical precursors, but basically build it in a chemical lab. And Monsanto, who was one of the pioneers of the caffeine industry in the U.S., they started extracting caffeine from waste tea leaves in 1905 for Coca-Cola. In the late 1940s, Monsanto built the first synthetic caffeine plant in the U.S., and Pfizer followed not much after that with another large synthetic caffeine plant in Groton, Connecticut. So this has been going on for a long time. There's been both naturally extracted caffeine from decaffeinated coffee primarily and synthetic caffeine. But what's happened that's different in the last 20 years is pretty much our entire caffeine industry has been offshored, and now most of it comes from pharmaceutical plants in China, Germany, and India.
Yeah, you tell an interesting story about trying to get into one of those plants in China.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. I had visited a decaffeination facility, the largest one in the U.S., in Texas. I really wanted to learn about the process of decaffeinating coffee and how you extract caffeine from coffee and how you produce caffeine that way. So when I learned that the synthetic caffeine industry was so big and such a critical part of our caffeine, caffeine economy, I really wanted to see the process, and I approached chemical plants in Germany, India, and China, and no one would allow me a tour. I did see the outside of one plant in China, and it was sort of in a rundown industrial park, but it was interesting to see it. It was the largest caffeine production plant in the world.
Well, let's go to the phones right now. We've got some listeners who would like to join in. We've got room for you, too, if you'd like. 800-642-1234. We begin in Milwaukee, and Wade joins us. Hi, Wade. Hi, Wade, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Okay, my question would be, I've heard in the past that the more coffee you drink today, the more coffee you need tomorrow to get the same effects. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Does your body not produce natural energy and, whatever, if you're drinking coffee? Is the caffeine a substitute?
Sure. Wade, what a great question. And Murray Carpenter, what about that? I mean, let's talk about two things. What the point Wade made, or the question he's got, and then that whole issue of addiction. Are we really addicted to caffeine?
Right. And they're related, of course. It is a really interesting question. So, yes, we develop a tolerance, and it tends to be a partial tolerance to caffeine, which is to say, if you're a habitual coffee drinker, you won't get the same effect from your next cup of coffee as you did from the very first cup of coffee you ever had. That definitely happens, but it tends to be what the researchers call a partial tolerance, which is to say we get to sort of a leveling off point. It's not like you keep needing more and more and more every day, and it just goes up and up and up. But we definitely develop a tolerance. And yes, this is addiction comes along with it, because as we develop a tolerance to habitual caffeine use, we also experience very recognizable withdrawal symptoms if we stop using caffeine abruptly. And for most people, the most apparent one, and it seems to be the one that people recognize most often when you talk about caffeine withdrawal, is a characteristic headache.
You mean that nail that gets driven right in the back of my head when I forget to hit that one?
that very one, yeah.
So what is happening in our body when we are drinking caffeine, when it gets in there?
Okay, and this is a very closely related question. So there's a neurotransmitter, adenosine, that tells the brain essentially that we're tired. And caffeine is able to basically sit in the receptors for adenosine and block adenosine from giving that message to the brain. And this is related to the issue of tolerance, because as we develop tolerance, we're actually producing more adenosine receptors to try to compensate for caffeine's blocking of those receptors. Now, there's some interesting and pretty good news about this. Even though we do develop a tolerance, if you quit for even as little as a week or 2 weeks, you're probably resetting yourself back to a baseline level where you have very little tolerance to caffeine, and you can start off at a low level again.
Let's head back to the phones right now. 800-642-1234, if you would like to join in. We go to Chicago, and Keith is with us. Hi, Keith.
Hi, I have a question concerning the produced caffeine and the natural caffeine. Is one better or worse than the other? Are they both marginally equal?
Good question, Keith. So does our body treat natural versus artificial caffeine in the same way, or are they processed differently?
It's a question I've heard often. There's nothing that I've seen that would suggest that we process it any differently. It's the exact same chemical, but interestingly, you can tell the compounds apart, natural versus synthetic caffeine, by stable isotope analysis or carbon dating, essentially, because the synthetic caffeine is the precursors typically come from fossil fuels, so the carbons were photosynthesized longer ago than natural caffeine. So I guess to put it the short way, no, if both are pure, if there's no impurities from the synthesizing or refining process, my understanding is your body would treat it exactly the same, and you would really need a lab analysis to tell the two compounds apart.
Turning back to the idea of regulations again for a moment, one of the things that you talk about in your book is that, some of the pills that we're familiar with, Nodos and Jetalert and those sorts of things do have some regulations attached to them. A cup of coffee, again, has more caffeine than some of those pills. Is this topic something that you, after you've done all the research and you've taken a hard look at this, is this something you think should be looked at more, or do you think the status quo is all right?
Well, in terms of I think in terms of the products that have caffeine added to them, and I don't just mean pills such as you're mentioning, but anything from Coke through energy drinks, I think because they're blending in a very precise amount of caffeine, I think it would make sense that it be very clearly and prominently labeled so people could know how much caffeine they're getting to be informed consumers. The question of coffee is, of course, much trickier because, for one thing, the caffeine levels in coffee can vary widely from day to day, from cup to cup. So it's much more of a challenge to label, and I think it would be very difficult to regulate. One thing I think that coffee producers can do is try to, in broadest terms, inform the public of approximate caffeine contents of various coffee brews.
And, you know, we've been talking about all these other drinks and so forth, but coffee is still the big one, right, in terms of caffeine intake?
It is. It's about two-thirds of our total caffeine consumption. And so even though we drink more, a greater number and volume of soft drinks, which are of caffeinated soft drinks, the caffeine concentration is much lower. So we're getting, about two-thirds of our caffeine nationwide is from coffee.
Let's take another phone call right now. Emily is with us from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. I actually had like a two-part question. How long does caffeine stay in your system, and what are the long-term health effects on your body of, you know, maybe that one or two cups of coffee every day?
Well, there's a couple of big questions. Murray Carpenter.
Okay. The first question is a little tricky. You know, typically the half-life is about 3 to 5 hours for most of us. But there's some interesting sort of drug interactions. So women on birth control pills tend to metabolize caffeine more slowly, and people who are smokers tend to metabolize caffeine more quickly. And in both cases, it has to do with an enzyme that the liver produces that helps to break down caffeine. Smokers produce more of it. Women on birth control pills produce less of it. And it gets even slightly more complicated here because there's a very big genetic influence in terms of how we process caffeine. So some people, we all know people like this, they can sort of guzzle coffee up until the moment they go to sleep and sleep like babies. And other people, you know, a cup of decaf, really a tiny amount of caffeine in the morning might keep them up that night. A lot of this really has to do with genetic variability. Now, the second part of your question, for people who aren't suffering from some of the well-known side effects of caffeine use, so increased anxiety or sleeplessness, there's nothing I've read to indicate that long-term moderate consumption of caffeine has any ill effects on your health.
Well, Murray, we're going to wrap it up. We're going to leave our audience wanting more. So thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Murray Carpenter is a journalist and an author. We've been talking about his new book, Caffeinated: How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us.